Our marshal was just telling me we aren't going to have any students today, and usually we have some students that are here on a program called Court with Class, but I guess the snow scared them away or something, who knows, or maybe they're out taking a break for a little recreation in the nice air. Anyway, we are set to begin our first case of the morning, McNally versus Capital Cartage. 15 AP 2627. Counsel, are you prepared to begin?
I am, Your Honor.
Please do.
May it please the Court, my name is Kathleen Detman, and I am counsel for Capital Cartage. The dispute at the heart of this case is whether or not a seller can be forced by operation of law to choose between selling or even giving away far more than it intended, or paying a commission to a broker who never fulfilled his part of the bargain on a proposed sale that never went through. Capital Cartage is asking this court to clarify the law on broker commissions and hold that a substantial variance can exist between a listing contract and an offer when a buyer introduces entirely new terms into the deal that were never contemplated in the listing itself. The listing contract at issue in this case accomplished what any listing contract is supposed to do. It identified exactly what the seller was willing to sell and at what price. When Capital Cartage and Mark McNally entered into the listing contract, Capital Cartage offered for sale essentially two items: the assets of its business and the real estate that the business operated out of. However, Steve Erickson's offer, also prepared by McNally, demanded far more than that. Erickson wanted the real estate, and he wanted the assets of the business. But he also wanted the personal service and labor of Capital Cartage's primary shareholder, Mary Hermanson. The labor issue is particularly important here because it was undetermined in the context of the offer itself exactly what shape that was going to take. It was going to be post-sale for an undetermined period of time and for no consideration, for no payment at all. Erickson also wanted a non-compete agreement, and he wanted Capital Cartage to advance a significant amount of money to help cover his appraisal costs and other costs associated with the transaction that would only be reimbursed if the deal closed.
Going through the offer to purchase, and on the first page, there's something written on line 45. So if you want to get it out, maybe you can help me. I want to be sure I understood what was being requested. And line 45 of the first page, it says, expenses incurred by the buyer in normal course of action. I didn't know what that meant, and I don't know if I read it correctly. So.
I think it is tough to read, Your Honor. I think that it looks like it says action, although that really doesn't make a lot of sense in the context.
Well, I thought maybe what you were just telling us about some expenses that the seller was being asked to pay the buyer for, I thought maybe that's what you were talking about, which is why I interrupted you at this point to try to clarify that, but that was a question I had just for myself as I was getting ready to hear the argument.
Your Honor, if you look at the addendum to the offer, and that's page 40 of Capital Cartage's appendix, this indicates that it's crossed out, but it indicates tentative terms and conditions relating to LOI, letter of intent, and the fifth bullet point down, that's the cost issue there. It indicates the lender required good faith deposit from Erickson, approximately $7,500 for appraisal and other costs, split between seller and buyer once financing is fully approved. It goes on and then indicates the seller to be reimbursed at full at closing.
Okay, so the seller was to front $7,500 of costs for the buyer?
The seller was to split that with the buyer, so half of that expense.
Okay. And was that to be repaid in full by the buyer if the deal went through?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So this was just when the buyer was deciding whether or not he would go through with the sale. Get
right.
The finances. I saw that he had to get financing and so forth.
Right. So if the deal didn't go through for whatever reason, even if the buyer couldn't achieve financing, then Capital Cartage would have been out that amount of money and never would have recovered it.
Okay, fine. Thank you. I understand better now.
The essence of the issue is that the buyer here, Stephen Erickson, wanted to buy a lot of things that were never offered for sale, and he didn't want to pay anything for them. The ultimate offer that we're talking about in this case was for $1.2 million, but when Capital Cartage executed the listing agreement for the price of $1.2 million, it only indicated certain items for sale. But when Steve Erickson indicates that he wants to pay that price, but he wants Capital Cartage to give him a lot more than Capital Cartage originally intended to give for that price.
Why isn't what you have in the offer to purchase just a counteroffer to the listing contract? So it's not really a counteroffer. It's just an offer. So if it's not acceptable, is there any legal obligation on the part of the seller to counter this offer?
There isn't a legal obligation to counter or address it if the variance or the issues that the seller doesn't like in the offer are substantial.
There is an obligation, a legal obligation, when you get an offer to purchase a property that's been listed, to respond to that offer, except you can't just deny it if you don't want it or refuse it, whatever the term would be.
Let me clarify. You can just deny the offer, but in that case, what's going to happen is exactly what happened here, which is the broker will say, well, I brought you an offer on the terms that we agreed under the listing contract, so now you owe me the commission.
I see. Okay.
That's the tough spot that the seller is in at that point.
Okay.
These cases involve a potential sale, but the sale didn't go through. And the sale doesn't go through. These cases involve a broker saying, I get a commission anyway from the seller, regardless of the fact that it didn't go through. And so what you have in these cases is no sale. Because if there was a sale, even if it were on different terms, there'd be money, and the broker would probably get it. But as I read these cases, which were Libowitz and Morse and Clevin, in all of them, the deal didn't go through.
Correct, Your Honor. So in that case, the seller really achieved no benefit at all from the transaction. That never happened.
And is being asked to pay money to the broker.
Correct. Being asked to pay money to the broker, the sale doesn't go through, and under the plain terms of the listing contract, the broker didn't perform. The broker didn't do what the broker was supposed to do, because the language contemplated in the contract is that the broker only gets paid, regardless of whether the sale gets through, if the broker brings an offer on substantially the same terms as what's in the listing agreement. Comparing the listing here and the offer, it's apparent readily from the face of these documents that these two things are not the same. There are substantial differences there.
Counsel, you're probably getting there anyway, but I wonder if you could kind of get to the part about the case law that was alluded to by Justice Abrahamson and the transformation of giving examples by use of the phrase such as and how that was transformed and what your position is why we should take it back to more of an example as opposed to a mandatory.
Yes, Your Honor. So Capital Cartage's position is that the operative law is still articulated in Clevin v. City Service, which is the seminal case in this area. The Clevin case indicated that the seller does not have to give notice to the broker of variances between the offer and the listing when it rejects the offer if those variances are substantial. And the idea behind that is that substantial variances are obvious, and so the broker is charged with knowledge that they exist. In articulating that rule, the Clevin court said that the variances The Clevin Court gave an example of a substantial variance as one that is a direct conflict between the listing and the offer. And so the subsequent cases have tried to address that issue and have at times interpreted the direct conflict issue to mean that if the listing contract is silent on something that's in the offer, and McNally's position reflects this, is that that can never be a substantial variance. What happened in Leibowitz is that it's in summarizing the Clevin rule, and the Leibowitz language makes clear that not only does it directly cite to the operative language in the Clevin case, that such as describing a substantial variance that could take the form of a direct conflict but doesn't have to take the form of a direct conflict. So Leibowitz cites that directly, and then it further indicates that it's going to summarize that rule. And in summarizing the rule, it substitutes a commonly used abbreviation for a Latin phrase, and it says, i.e., instead of what our position is that the more appropriate phrase would have been e.g., which stands for example, i.e. is that is, which McNally has interpreted to mean that the only way you can have a substantial variance is if there's a direct conflict in language between the listing and the offer. The reason why that's so problematic and why that leads to such absurd results is that what it means, practically speaking, is that a buyer can invent any term it wants and put that in the offer and say that I want to buy all of the things you're putting out here in this listing contract, but I also want you to work for me for free for an undetermined period of time.
Or, for instance, could add a term such as involuntary servitude.
Correct. And from our perspective, what's in the offer here is essentially involuntary servitude.
Did you look up the definition of involuntary servitude?
I did not, Your Honor. But in my estimation, what we're talking about here is forced labor for free for an undetermined period of time.
To be a little more specific, from my reading of the record, the first 3 months were supposed to be free. And then after the first 3 months, there was supposed to be a discussion that was going to take place about what the terms of the wages and the duration of the work might be.
So at least
some wages after the first 3 months were contemplated.
The letter of intent that the parties discussed before the offer was issued by Erickson did have that type of provision in it. However, the actual language of the offer doesn't incorporate all of the language in the original letter of intent, and so looking at the four corners of the document, it just indicates that Mary Hermanson, the shareholder in Capital Cartage, to stay on full time and without pay for period outlined in proposed structure. Well, there is no proposed structure in the context of the offer. McNally's trying to enforce these documents on a four corners argument that everything we need is contained in here. That's how the case law analyzes these documents. And there's nothing in here that tells us when and how Mary Hermanson is supposed to be paid, if at all, and for how long.
Counsel, is substantial variance a question of fact or a question of law?
I think oftentimes the determination of substantiality is going to be a question of fact. It's going to be something for the jury to decide. There are cases, however, and this is one such case, where there is no real genuine dispute about the facts because the variances here and the issues that are arising in this offer with forcing Mary Hermanson to work for an undetermined period of time for free are so extreme and so patently obvious that the court should have and could have ruled as a matter of law that they were substantial.
Right. So let's take the latter two of the three additional terms and compare them to each other, and then perhaps you can tell me how we are to determine which is a question of fact and which a question of law. So the third term, the uncompensated personal services, you say that's a question of law because that is an additional item that would be sold as a part of this transaction that's not listed in the listing contract, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And the idea is, well, Mrs. Hermanson wanted to retire, right? That's kind of the point of selling the business. So we step back now to the second of the three additional terms, the non-compete. Is that a question of fact as to whether that is a substantial variation? Because that seems to be accomplishing her very expressed desire to no longer work.
Well, I think once you determine that there's at least one variance that can be resolved as a question of law, then you wouldn't need to go any farther. However,
yeah, that's true as far as the principle is concerned. But what we, when we write this opinion, it may come to a point where we need to have some kind of an analytical device that helps us distinguish between which additional terms need to be sent to the jury for analysis versus the ones the court can do on its own.
I think that the non-compete could be determined as a question of law, and the reason is this. There's a lot of public policy in this state that addresses non-competes when they're appropriate and when the offeror of a non-compete or the person that's supposed to benefit from it, when it's appropriate to inject that into a transaction. I think that by adding the non-compete as a new term, when it's not contemplated in the listing agreement, you're essentially saying that you can force someone into a non-compete agreement entirely against their will, or alternatively, they have to pay a broker commission, right? So I think that that is another example of a more extreme case that should be determined as a matter of law. I also think, although it's a closer question, that the financial outlay, the paying half of the appraisal costs and the like, could be determined as a matter of law here because, well, for a couple reasons. One is that you're requiring someone to pay money out of their pocket in order to try to achieve a closing that may or may not happen, they may or may not get. So I think that from a practical perspective and a legal perspective, that's a pretty significant difference that a court can see readily and that could be determined as a matter of law. However, of the three factors, that one is probably the closest call in terms of whether or not you could decide that as a matter of fact or a matter of law.
On that first of the three additional terms, it struck me that perhaps the resolution on whether the broker has earned his commission would not be determined until the deal either closed or did not close, right? Because if it closed, then the seller's not out anything because she gets reimbursed, correct?
Correct.
All right. So on that one, how do we know that she would have been out something if she had accepted the offer?
You wouldn't, Your Honor. There wouldn't be a way to predict that in advance unless and until you get to the point where either, you know, Erickson says, I can't get financing, I have to back out.
Right. So if it's not something that we can predict in advance, whether she'd actually be out anything, how would we be able to say that's a substantial variation from the listing contract?
Because I think you're asking the seller to accept a risk that the seller never contemplated taking on when it executed the listing agreement.
How would you distinguish that risk from the risk inherent in every potential transaction of it not going through?
Well, because I think in these kinds of deals, generally speaking, that the seller is taking very little risk. I mean, that's sort of contemplated, that either the deal goes through the way the seller wants it, as outlined in the listing contract, or it doesn't. But generally, the advance expenses and things that are required to be paid prior to closing are going to be a buyer's obligation. I think one thing that might help illustrate this a little bit is if you look at the thrust of the Leibowitz case, for example, and the way the court analyzed the variances there, the court was focusing quite a bit on how is this term, if at all, going to affect the seller? What kind of imposition or additional obligation are we putting on the seller?
Right. So let me just give you perhaps a run-of-the-mill example. This does involve the sale of real estate. What if the offer said, and by the way, seller, you need to provide a title insurance policy at your own expense? That would be something that was not identified in the listing contract, right?
Correct.
Okay. So that would be an additional term. And the additional term would be something requiring the seller to make an out-of-pocket expenditure prior to closing, correct?
Yes.
All right. So how would that differ from a requirement that the seller share the good faith deposit required by the lender?
Well, I think to some extent this is all a matter of degree.
Precisely. Shouldn't that go to the jury?
In those kinds of cases, yes. I think the close calls do have to go to the jury because, you know, as we started this conversation, it's definitely the case that a lot of these are going to end up going to the jury. But the fact also remains that a lot of these are going to be, some of these cases are going to be significant outliers. And when it's a significant outlier, I think the court is empowered to rule as a matter of law that forced labor for free for an unlimited period of time is a substantial variance. It cannot be the law that a buyer can inject whatever term it wants, and the seller either has to accept it or be forced to pay a commission, because that just puts the seller at the mercy of the creativity of the buyer. Now, as Your Honor pointed out, there are going to be a number of these issues that are closer calls or that perhaps really ought to go to the jury. And in fact, in this case here, you know, as we maintain in the briefing, the court really should have ruled on this as a matter of law, because the plain face of the documents show that these are significant differences, putting a huge burden on the seller. However, once the court decided that it couldn't rule as a matter of law, it erred again when it took the issue away from the jury by modifying the standard instruction to say, actually, I can rule as a matter of law, and these things cannot be substantial
but
because
counsel,
of the...
But, counsel, it almost seems to me as if you're making a concession that is putting the cart before the horse, because you first started your argument today, which is the tact I thought you were going to really keep going on, like a ship navigating from one end of the lake or ocean to the other, which is to clarify the law. Now, before we get into what is a factual question, it seems to me that our court has to settle what the law is when it comes to substantial variance. And it seems to me that in your brief, you did a pretty clear job of outlining the evolution of one case using as an example, well, i.e., such as when a term proposed was not listed in the original offer for sale. And then that got, your argument is, then that got turned into an ironclad rule that whenever something is different from what existed, then that got turned on its head. Now, it seems to me you're kind of going down a rabbit hole of saying, well, we do have to have a factual determination. Before we can send it back for any kind of factual determination, it seems to me you're going to want to ask us to really clarify. And right now, I'm not understanding. I understand more from your brief than I understand from the argument you're making. And I know your yellow light is on, but you're going to have 5 minutes to come back, and you might really want to think about your strongest argument for why we should go back to the way you're suggesting in your brief that it should be. Otherwise, you want us to avoid the absurd result in your argument, the absurd result of a potential purchaser coming in and throwing in all sorts of conditions, such as a potential involuntary servitude of someone who's looking to retire after 40 years of building up a business and saying, I'm done. We've built this business up. We started when we were young. We're no longer young. We're done. And now the potential purchaser wants me to work for free. I don't want to do that, but now I don't want to be on the hook for $72,000. You see my point?
I do, Your Honor.
And it's the point you made in your brief, but you're not, I think you're kind of getting led around to something that you don't need to get into before you make your pitch for why we should clarify the law.
Your Honor, as we articulated in our brief, and as I will very briefly state now, the standard that we're asking the court to apply
yes.
is the standard in Clevin. It's Clevin is the law, and we need the court to clarify that Leibowitz never changed it, never intended to change it, and that that standard makes sense. Clevin said that a substantial variance such as one directly in conflict.
What I hear you articulating is something, and when I read your brief, it called to mind, and I see the red light is on. And I say this, too, to the your opposing counsel who are going to speak next. One of the things that I learned from another member of this bench who's been here the longest, and one of the wisest things I ever heard her opine on about the law and about legal writing, and it's something that I've remembered in the years since I heard her say it, is that whenever you restate something, she was addressing the rest of the court, whenever you restate something, you change it. And I thought to myself, this might be a prime example of what happened in between Clevin and, I can't remember how to pronounce it, Leibowitz or whatever it is. And so I say that knowing that your opposing counsel will now have a chance to convince as to why that's not the case, and you will have 5 minutes on rebuttal. Thank you for answering my questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I'm Robert Proctor, and I'm the attorney for Mark McNally. I'm going to start by addressing Justice Gableman's question right from the beginning. So the way the case law developed in this case, as the court has seen in the briefs, was originally the case was Moss v. Warnes.
Would you please, there's a button that allows you to lift that, raise that podium. It's
should
on
be
the
on
right
your
hand.
Right, yeah. Good.
Thank you.
Better?
Yes, yes, much better.
In Moss v. Warnes, a seller hired a listing broker, entered into a contract, and that's an important part, a contract. At that point, the seller decided to sell their home. They had a potential buyer come into the home. They showed the home to the buyer. And then when the offer to purchase came in, the seller decided that they no longer wanted to sell the home and walk away from the contract. And in that case, the court set a very bright line rule that says, you can walk away from the contract. You don't have to sell the house. But if you want to avoid paying the commission, you have to object to the reasons in the offer to purchase. So the next case that comes along is Clevin.
Let me play that out just a little bit, because I live 70 miles away from Madison, and so I got plenty of time to think on the drive. And one of the hypotheticals that occurred to me on the drive-in was within the context of a home seller. And I thought to myself, within the context of this case, okay, I want to sell my house or a house that I own. And someone kind of listed with a realtor, and an offer comes in that's pretty close, maybe even the asking price. Oh, but there's just one thing, Justice Gableman. We want you to stay on for 3 months, and we want you to continue to do the lawn maintenance and, you know, just for a transition period of 3 months. And just so we get used to how things work at the house. And, you know, every house has its idiosyncrasies. And then after the three-month period, we'll work out some kind of compensation where you continue to do the chores and everything like that. Substantial variance?
Not if it's not listed in the listing contract.
Okay, so that is where you are running to Leibowitz. You are hanging your hat on Leibowitz.
I'm hanging my hat on Leibowitz.
Live and die by Leibowitz.
I don't live and die by
Leibowitz. No, you don't. Then what is your second? What's your default? If we don't say, as your opposing counsel says, it's a matter of perhaps some scrivener's error, a law clerk, or someone not paying attention between the difference between IE and EG, such as, I mean, Clevin. You compare the language in Clevin, such as, and then you compare it to Leibowitz. Oh, well, if it's not in there, then it's a... What's your second most powerful argument besides Leibowitz?
Yeah, I'm going to just get you there through this. So Clevin, when Clevin announced the qualification to the Moss v. Warren's rule, the posture of that case said that there had been a trial to the trial judge and the facts... And there had been findings of fact that there were material differences between the listing contract and the offer. So the court never applied the standard of what a substantial variance is. It just announced the qualification. When you get to Leibowitz, it actually applies the qualification. And in Leibowitz, it says a number of things. We believe the better rule is to have the that is in direct conflict because it's a bright line rule with consistent results. But there's also language in
Leibowitz. So the answer to my original question is yes, I'm on the hook to either pay the commission or stay on as the chore man.
No, that's incorrect. You can also simply object to the provision when the offer to purchase comes back. So if you look at the listing contract, putting this into how it really occurred, so, Your Honor, Justice Gableman, you hired me to sell your house.
Yes.
I'm a good faith realtor.
Yes.
And under the listing contract in this case, it specifically puts a duty on me that comes from statute that says, when negotiating on behalf of a party, present contract proposals in an objective and unbiased manner and disclose the advantages and disadvantages of those proposals. So I go out and I procure an offer to purchase. And I come and I bring it to you. And I say to you, Justice Gableman, this is a full price offer to purchase. It's everything you wanted. It's got this really odd term in it.
Except what?
It's got this odd term in it. It's going to require you to either pay for or cut the grass for 4 months. And so what do you think of that, Justice Gableman? Is that a term that's acceptable to you or not? I assume you're going to say it's not acceptable to you. And I'm going to say, okay. Now I have to go back and get an offer without that term. And you've preserved your ability to argue that the contract was not, that the offer was in substantial variance to the listing contract. And I think your hypothetical, why I like it so much, it really illustrates a point. What is truly material and how do we know if the seller doesn't say it? Because possibly, Justice Gableman, you live in a retirement community or you live in a homeowners association. Well, I apologize.
I'm only 51.
Well, I know you've done very well with your investments.
So I've always looked a little older than my age. But go ahead.
Believe me, I feel older now.
Continuing on.
So I come to you and I say, Justice Gableman, everything's perfect in this offer, but there's this one odd term, and I have to explain it to you that it's a disadvantage to you. You have to, they want you to take care of the grass for 3 months. And that's, I think that you should reject that. And you may say to me, actually, that's not material to me. The Homeowners Association takes care of it. They know that. And all they're actually saying is to make sure my dues are paid up for the quarter so that the grass is cut.
Okay.
So to say that we don't know what's material, to say that we are going to just know what's material as a broker, it's not possible. The listing contract is 6 pages long. It's initialed at every page. You discuss every term. The three terms in this case, I know when you read them the first time, they kind of jump out at you. But when you read the facts of this case, you say, what happened? Mark McNally brought a buyer to the seller.
Counsel, before you go there, I'm going to suggest to you that you don't like Justice Gableman's hypothetical, and here's why. And it was because of part of your response to it. So that odd term, you referred to that as being that he would either need to do the lawn himself or pay someone to do it.
Correct.
The offer that was brought to him was then, therefore, not a full-price offer. It was full price minus the cost of cutting the lawn. Correct?
I disagree, Dee. If you look at the Leibowitz application of the cases, and it'll go back to your...
So put Leibowitz to a side for the moment. There is value to human labor, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So when the allegedly full price offer comes along and says, and in addition to this, I'm going to require uncompensated labor from you, and you can fulfill that either by paying it yourself or doing the labor uncompensated, then I propose to you that the economic terms of that offer are not full price. Why would I be wrong in coming to that conclusion?
I believe you're too narrow in looking at the comparisons, and I'll first explain it before I turn to case law to show that case law has looked at that. When you look at the offer to purchase and a listing contract, and your prior question articulated this before, the listing contract is not going to put everything in it. And the listing contract is, and anything that's in addition to it, and the listing contract specifically says that the offer doesn't have to be on the exact same terms. It says on substantially the terms. And the listing contract, any term that is added to an offer to purchase that's not in the listing contract is going to have some value. So, for example, it's customary in the real estate practice in Dane County that sellers will pay for the owner's policy for the buyer and for the and for half of the closing costs. Now, if those terms aren't specifically in the listing contract, the value of the offer may be different, but the set purchase price in the listing contract is the same as the purchase price in the offer to purchase.
I want to know how wedded you're going to be to this position. So let's change up the hypothetical a little bit. We'll go back to Capital Cartage. It's selling not just the real estate, but the business. So here comes the offer. It's $1.2 million. Additional term, though, is that the seller has to cover all the expenses of the operation of that business for 2 years. Is that a full-price offer?
The full-price offer, I would suggest that the price in the offer and the price in the listing contract are the same, so it's a full-price offer.
Okay, let me change it up. Let me change it up a little bit more for you then. So the offer comes in, it says $1.2 million, and over the next 2 years, you rebate me $1.2 million. Is that a full-price offer?
That's not a full-price offer, and because, as Leibowitz would explain, is that there is the circumstance, and I believe the exact language would be this. The exact language in Leibowitz is that if it's a implied but obviously material term, then it may still be a substantial variance. And in this case, obviously, if the material term is I'm going to have an offer of $1.2 million, giving all the money back would obviously violate that term.
Okay. And so what about just paying all the expenses of the business for the next 2 years?
I would argue that we don't know if that's a material term to the seller, because facts matter, and if you walk through how these deals happen and what the obligations are on each party, we don't know if there's been a discussion before there was a listing contract signed that said, listen, I'll sell for $1.2 million, but also, just so you know, I'm willing to prepay the expenses for 2 years.
Okay, so that leads me to my next question, which is the proper comparison between the offer and the listing contract, or do we bring in extraneous information?
The reason the extraneous, well, The reason the facts in this case are important is because if
hang on, the... Hang on. Before I can understand your the rest of your answer, I need to know yes or no. Is the proper comparison between the terms of the offer and the terms of the listing contract?
The proper comparison is between the terms of the offer and the terms of the listing contract to determine whether there are substantial variances.
Yes. Okay. Continue.
Okay. But the reason the law is correct, the reason Leibowitz is correct in saying that that term has to be in direct conflict with an actual term in the listing contract is because that's what gives knowledge and notice to the broker that it's material to the seller. If it's not in there, and that's where the facts of this case come in, then all the seller has to do when presented with that term, and in our case, the seller was presented with those terms on multiple occasions, and the conduct and words, in the words of the buyer, agreed to those terms, is why they end up in the offer to purchase. So she had two choices when those terms are presented. She can reject them or she can agree to them.
Okay, hang on. That's step two, right? Sure. So the first step is to determine whether the broker acquired an offer that complies with the listing contract, right?
Correct.
So is it your position that in this case, if the offer had come in with an additional requirement that the seller paid the expenses of the business for the next 2 years, that the broker would not understand that to be a substantial variance?
If it's not been told to the broker at the time of the listing contract and not put in the listing contract, the broker would not know that that's a material term to the seller.
So in other words, it would have to be in the listing. Seller will not pay the expenses for the following 2 years in order to fit within your interpretation of Leibowitz?
Correct.
Okay.
Isn't the broker the agent of the seller?
Correct.
Doesn't that agency require a duty of loyalty to the seller to be sure the seller understands variances between the listing contract and the offer to purchase?
Correct. That is specifically in the listing contract as a requirement and by state law.
Well, I look at the terms on lines 261 to 264, which is really about the only thing that's in there much on the commission that the broker earns. And so is there anything in the record that this broker explained that the sellers did not have to accept this offer to purchase and they could just say, hey, we want the price is fine, but we don't want to work anymore. That's why we're retiring. Is that in the record that the broker did that?
There was ample opportunity for her to object. So first,
but that wasn't my question. I was focusing on the obligation of the broker as an agent of the seller. So when you're an agent of the seller, you have certain obligations that you wouldn't have if you were Joe Blow on the street. And my question is, did the broker explain to the seller that they didn't have to accept this part of the offer? They could just come back and say, no, we won't do those things. The dollar amount is fine, but we won't do those things. Was that explained, that they could counter what was given to them?
The record was clear that he was not given that opportunity. When the offer to purchase was signed and delivered, he emailed it to the seller. He called her on multiple occasions. He called her and her attorney. He sent an email that's in the record. And in the email, he said, the offer expires today. I need to talk to you. I believe we can get more money. And the response from the seller was the seller's attorney sent a letter saying that the seller, the shareholders of the sellers have met and decided they no longer wish to sell the business and that they request that he not contact the president of the seller anymore about it, this matter.
Counsel, first of all,
I'm done. Thank you, ma'am.
I want to return to this concept of fact or law. Is it your position that you need both a substantial and a material variance?
I believe that the cases have viewed those, well, as the Court of Appeal said, a bit interchangeably. So I believe you need a substantial variance. And I believe for it to be a substantial variance under Leibowitz, it has to directly conflict with a material term in the listing contract. So if you have a term in the offer that directly conflicts with a material term in the listing contract, you have a substantial variance.
This occurs to me, and I'd like your pushback or response to it, that in order to view a whether there is a substantial variance, you can do that as a matter of law. You look at the listing contract, you look at the offer to purchase. The offer to purchase has what has been labeled by some as involuntary servitude, and I would say, seems like a substantial change to me. But then you look at the facts of the case, and the facts of the case perhaps raise the factual question of whether or not it was material under the circumstances. That is, as I understand some of the facts of this case, there were discussions before any offer to purchase was submitted, that after the and these three, I'll call, variances were raised, and there was, it's asserted, no objection or comment or anything to indicate non-acceptance of those three variances. Then there was a letter of intent which set forth those three variances, and there was no indication about that of any objection. That there was a pushback with regard to the one, a request that the listing contract be increased to $1.4 million from $1.2 million. That wasn't done. You have the offer to purchase. So it appears to me that there's an argument that whether or not this substantial variance, look at it, it's substantial, is also material, depends on the facts of this case. That's an analytical framework. Tell me what's wrong with that analytical framework, or what's right with it?
Well, what's right with it is the key is materiality. Is a substantial variance isn't because the item's substantial. If you look at the facts in Leibowitz, there's many substantial items. One of the items in Leibowitz, and I'm going to get to here, but is the tax allocation. In Leibowitz, the court looks at the tax allocation and says, if we allocate the tax this way, it's going to have a negative effect on the seller. In essence, it could change the purchase price. And the court says, no, that's not a substantial variance because it was not set forth in the listing contract. So what you need is a substantial variance means that you need a material term to the seller that is in variance in the offer. And the seller has to tell the broker what those material terms are, so the broker's on knowledge, in one of two places. When they sit down at the listing contract stage, they can tell them, here are my material terms. If they forget, if they didn't think of it, if it wasn't material at the time, there's a second time they can raise it. When they receive the offer to purchase, the broker is going to go through the offer to purchase, explain points to them, and at that point they can say, wait, this additional term is material to me, and I object to it. And now that's a substantial variance. It can be a substantial variance also. What you don't have, and I would submit this, and so that's where it matters, where you do need a material term, and the reason the facts are important is because the way this has been set up through case law and the state-approved forms, we assume the state understands the case law. These transactions happen all the time. As we cited in our brief, there is 80,000 residential transactions in 2016 in the state. There's four reported cases reported cases on this rule. The first one, what happened? The seller decided to not sell their property. They decided to walk away from the contract.
Let me interject. Yeah. Are you agreeing or disagreeing with my analytical construct?
I would say, well, if I understand it, I'm agreeing with it because I'm saying this, is that determining whether there's a substantial variance, and in this case I'll explain it to you, it's a legal requirement that it be material to the seller. It's a factual requirement that the seller either told the broker about it at the time of the listing contract or objected to it at the time of the offer is received. That's what creates the substantial variance.
Counsel, I thought you wanted a bright line rule where you would just compare the offer to the listing contract.
Yes. And I want to follow up both on Justice and Bradley's and with Justice Kelly, because I'm having the same problem. It seemed to me in your brief you were a lot more rigid, and in your answer to my question you were a lot more rigid, and then you kind of massaged it. You were a lot more nuanced in your response to Justice and Bradley's question. It seemed to me, just as Justice Kelly was about to ask, that you want the bright line test of Leibovitz. If it's not prohibited by the offer to sale, by the offer to sell, then it's anything goes.
And this is where I led to the confusion, and you're absolutely correct. I want the bright line of Leibovitz. When you look at the offer to purchase and the listing contract, if the listing contract is silent as to the term, it's not a substantial variance.
Okay.
Where I have tried to explain or push back is that doesn't mean the seller has to accept the term. It doesn't mean that the seller owes the commission at that point. It only means that if the seller is going to later argue that the term in the offer, in variance to the silence in the listing contract, should relieve them of a commission, then when the offer comes in, they have to object to it.
Yeah, but that assumes that you have secured a conforming offer, correct?
Correct.
That assumes what? I didn't hear the last.
That he has procured a conforming offer, an offer that substantially complied with the terms in the listing contract. So let me look at it perhaps a little bit differently and see if I can suss this out. What was McNally engaged to sell?
McNally was engaged to sell the business.
To sell what?
To sell the business.
Okay. And were Mrs. Hermanson's personal services part of the assets of that business?
Arguably, it depends on how you view goodwill. Without, you know, any business, when you're going to transition a business, you don't buy a business. Somebody has developed a business for 40 years. They have all the know-how. They have all the contacts. And
let me slow you down just a wee scotch there before you go somewhere you don't want to. Are you suggesting to me that an asset of the business is the future personal services of the seller?
No,
the answer is no.
As stated as you're stating it, no.
The answer is no. That's okay. So so you were not engaged to sell the personal services of the seller, correct?
Well, depending on the circumstances, I don't quite.
Capital Cartage versus McNally.
Mm-hmm. 3 months.
McNally was not engaged to sell the personal services of Mrs. Hermanson, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So that's not one of the assets that were offered for sale, yes?
Correct.
Okay. So now when an offer came and the offer said, I'm going to buy the assets of the business and something that you were not engaged to sell and have no authority to sell, I'm also going to buy this $1.2 million, the future personal services of Mrs. Hermanson, are you telling me that an offer that includes what you're engaged to sell and what you're not engaged to sell is not substantially variant from an offer that would only address assets you were engaged to sell?
I would argue that if you adopt that rule, that would overturn all the existing case law, because that means that anything that comes in the offer to purchase in addition to what's in the listing contract would be something additional that I wasn't hired to sell. And the way realty works, the market has always worked that when I go to sell your house, I go to sell Justice Gableman's house, the listing contract probably doesn't attach a list of things like the basketball hoop, the removable grill, or any of those issues. And the idea is that when I come in and explain the terms to him, if none of those were in there, I don't know their material. That means they can't be substantial variances.
But you do know that it would be not a full price. You do know it would not be a full price offer. Because, let me explain. So if his house is $1.2 million and you say, I also want your really nice barbecue grill in the backyard, then the price for the house, what you were contracted to sell, is $1.2 million less the value of the barbecue, right?
And I would argue that would overturn not just Leibowitz, that would overturn Clevin.
Counselor, I look at this case a little bit different than Moss and some of the other cases that were cited, because this is more than, although there's real estate involved, it's really a business that was contracted to be sold. So I'm not sure that whatever rule comes out of this case is necessarily easily transferred to simply the listing of a house for sale.
I would agree that there's certainly differences. In this case, we have a sophisticated seller who's negotiated listing contracts in the past with attorneys, all in the record, and negotiated the terms that ended up in the offer to purchase. So it's a different world than in the simple real estate rule. But I would go back to, there's four cases published that deal with this rule. All four cases have something in common. There's no case out there published. There's no, in the realtor's brief they talk about, there's no evidence of complaints against realtors to the state of Wisconsin where brokers are trapping sellers. There's four cases. The first one, the seller changed their mind and walked away from the contract. The second one, the seller changed their mind and walked away from the contract. The third one, the seller received a competing offer where they wouldn't have to pay the commission and tried not to pay the commission. The fourth one, Chalik, the seller decided to walk, that they no longer wanted to sell. And when you write this opinion, the end of your facts is going to talk about the fact that the seller had their attorney write a letter saying they no longer wanted to sell. The only people getting tripped up by this rule out of the millions of transactions since 1944 are people who decide that I'm going to enter into a contract as an adult to sell an incredibly important investment of mine, and when the broker goes out and procures an offer and brings it back to me and it has a term that's not in the listing contract, I'm going to say nothing? That's why those cases don't happen. It's the easiest thing to do. You can say something and put it in the listing contract because it's a big deal to you, such as your grill or your basketball hoop.
How about his car?
Where the car?
So he would have to say, this offer to purchase my house does not include my car. That'd have to be in the listing contract. And if it's not in the listing contract, if the offer says the house plus the car, that's not a substantial variance.
It's not a substantial variance because it's not the substantiality of the item. It's whether the offer to purchase is in variance with a material term in the listing contract. That's the substantiality. All this rule does, it's so easy. All this rule says is if you didn't say it to the listing broker at the time of the listing contract, that when he, exercising his legal obligated duty, and besides, there's criminal penalties if he doesn't do that. May I finish, Your Honor, my
rebuttal? Yes, please.
When he hands you the offer to purchase and explains, Justice Gableman, they put your car in there. Can you believe that? How dumb is that? All you do is say, yeah, I agree, that's dumb. Go tell them they can't have my car. I mean, it's such, and the farther you push out the fact pattern of the most ridiculous point, this conversation happens every time. And I think in the state of Wisconsin, adult residents and businesses have the ability to respond. And so, for the reasons stated in the brief, and I thank you for the little bit of additional time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So, counsel, why didn't your client say, I'm not working anymore, I'm retiring? Did they say it at the time of the listing contract? Did they say it? Apparently, they didn't say anything at the time of the offer.
The issue of notice, I think, is being misconstrued here. The notice issue is a question of waiver. It's not a question of substantiality. If Capital Cartage had objected, that doesn't make the term that we're talking about any less substantial. McNally could have, and I'm assuming would have still sued, saying that that's fine. You can object, But I brought you an offer on substantially the same terms because these three things are not substantial variances from the listing contract.
Okay, so that's different. I mean, what he's saying now is that you compare the listing contract with the offer to purchase. But then he also added, if you forgot to put it in the listing contract, then you need to tell the broker at the time the offer is presented.
I think saying that flies in the face of the rule of Clevin and of Leibowitz, because the law is clear that when the variance is substantial, you don't have a duty to point it out. Moreover, the Clevin test is a two-pronged test. First, you ask the question of substantiality. First, you figure out whether or not the variance is substantial. If you say it is, case over, whether it's a factual question or a legal question. If you say it wasn't substantial, then you say, well, was there notice? Because if there wasn't notice, then you, the seller, have waived your ability to make this argument. But the notice question doesn't resolve whether or not something is substantial. Had Capital Card had given notice, we would still be here today arguing about what the law is on substantiality.
And, counsel, the reason for the substantial variance analysis in the first step is because that's designed to figure out, did the broker bring to the seller what the broker promised to bring, right?
Absolutely.
So if the broker didn't bring what he promised to bring, there's no need to object to the fact that he didn't do what he promised to do.
Correct. No commission can be owed if the broker didn't fulfill his obligations under the contract. That's why the court looks at substantiality first and notice second.
Tell me, counsel, if you had the opportunity to write the majority opinion, and I want you to focus in just on the holding line. You made an allusion.
I'm sorry, I missed you there.
Just the holding line, the line we hold. And you made a reference to it at the very beginning of your argument, but you didn't really complete your thought. I wonder, and our... Typically, we shoot for, you know, one sentence when we hold. What would it be?
It would be, we hold that the standard this court articulated in Clevin is the law of this state, meaning that a substantial variance, that a direct conflict between a listing and an offer is one way that you could have a substantial variance. It is not the only way.
Thank you for
answering. Let me ask you this, counsel. Let's say under these facts, the negotiations were going on for several months, and the broker is involved with those negotiations between the buyer and the seller. And let's say there's no dispute. In the 11th hour, the deal's about to close, and the buyer throws in a requirement that everyone agrees is a substantial variance from what they've been negotiating, okay? You're with me so far?
Yes.
And let's say the negotiations then extend for a period of time and the broker's putting in all this time into negotiating the deal. Does the seller get to walk away even though they raise no objection to the substantial variances that have been negotiated over time just because of this one at the end and the broker doesn't get a commission?
In this scenario, Your Honor, we're agreeing that the variance is substantial. Is that your hypothetical? Yes. I think that because the broker didn't perform. The broker only gets paid if the broker brings an offer that is substantially on the same terms as the listing.
Well, let's go back to the scenario that we do have. And let's say we agree that the three additional terms were substantial variances. So the broker shouldn't have any opportunity to go to your client and say, you know, what do you think about these? And she says, I'm fine with that. That's fine. So they keep negotiating. And it seems to me at the end, she said, no, I'm done. But she didn't seem to, I haven't found anything in the record where she actually objected. That doesn't strike me as fair or reasonable applying our current law, that at that point all the time that the broker spent relying on your client not objecting to these terms, all that time he spent gets uncompensated because she changed her mind at the end. That's one way of looking at this case. So could you respond to that? Your light's on.
Sure. I'll respond briefly. There are facts in the record that show that Mary Hermanson and Capital Cartage did not like the offer as it was presented. And there were conversations with McNally. I would also say that if we're talking about the facts of this case, the facts are also clear that the relationship between McNally and Capital Cartage had deteriorated significantly by the time the offer was brought, and that Mary indicated that she canceled upcoming meetings because he was yelling at her. So I think that if we're going to talk about the facts of this case specifically and why didn't she do this and why didn't she do that, I would have to keep going back to what does the law require her to do? If the variances are not substantial, if the variances are substantial, the law says that the broker is charged with that knowledge as the fiduciary in this case. My time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both very much for a really, really interesting real estate case. The briefs were very helpful and the arguments were well done. We're going to take a brief recess so that the second case for the morning can be set up, and we are adjourned.